Good afternoon, everyone, on this beautiful Friday afternoon in Anchorage. I'm Charles Woolforth, and this is a special edition of Hometown Alaska. You usually hear us on Wednesdays, but we have a good reason for that. We have a really exciting guest and someone who's got everybody here sort of fluttering around because she's a real radio professional and knows what she's doing. So I kind of feel like I should turn it over to her. The guest today is Leanne Hansen, who is, of course, the host of Sunday Weekend Edition for the last two decades and is on a sort of farewell tour going to stations around the country. And we're lucky enough to have her here this week, and she'll be giving a talk this evening and meeting listeners. And so for the next hour, we're going to be talking to Leanne Hansen about NPR, about her career and her life and interests and points of view. And it's your opportunity to get on the phone with her and ask anything you want. So if you, you've heard the number before, but please do call in today. It's going to be fun. The number here is 550-8433. That's within Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, it's toll-free call 888-353-5752. And you can send an email to hometownalaska@kska.org. If you're emailing, do make sure you use that Hometown Alaska address. If you send it to my personal address, I won't get it because I'm in the studio. Well, thanks for being here, Leanne. It's just wonderful to meet you. And I'm so, you know, your voice is a part of my life. So it's always fun to put the voice together with the
face.
Person.
And yeah. I hope it doesn't disturb you too much see the face behind the voice. Thank you, Charles, for having me on the air.
On the contrary, yeah. So tell us about you've decided to retire after all these years, and that's will be traumatic for those of us who get up early on Sunday, which I am one of those, is sitting with the newspaper early Sunday morning while everyone else sleeps. And
yeah.
So what's next for you, or why are you moving on?
Well, you said, I've been at the job for 22 years. I've been in public broadcasting for 35 years. And I've reached a stage in my life where I've been doing it so long that I feel we've got some youngsters coming up and want to give them a chance. I sort of want to be able to leave on top. But part of it is it's sort of a convergence of events. I'm going to turn 60 this year. I own a place at the beach in Delaware, and I've always wanted to live by the ocean ever since I was a kid because my family grew up by the ocean in Massachusetts. And this was an opportunity to do it. And I thought, okay. And it's a little scary, but I keep remembering the old Zen saying, leap and the net will appear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to live where I'm happy and everything else will follow. I have a few ideas about what I'd like to do to pursue some altruistic things. I love the beach community, maybe write, maybe act, take photographs, and pursue some commercial voiceover work to actually have a little bit of income other than my retirement income, so I don't want to give up. But goodbye doesn't mean forever. It doesn't mean I won't show up again somewhere on NPR. But it's 20 years is a long time to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning every Sunday and you know, to not have the same days off as everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel it. You feel it in your gut that it's time for you to make a change. And so I just acted on that.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're doing it in this very unusual way of traveling around the country. And you were saying before we got on that this is just your idea of something you wanted to give back to the people who listen.
What everyone doesn't understand that without you, I am nothing. I wouldn't exist. And there are so many station program directors and managers that have had faith in this program to keep us on the air. And because of that, so many listeners have supported the program. And I really wanted to come face to face and to tell them how much you've meant to me doing the show. I mean, I know it seems to be it's all about everybody meeting me, but really this is about me meeting you for the first time. And to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
It must be great to get that feedback from people that you haven't.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, everybody has listened to certain things. They all have different questions about the program from, you know, do I only work one day a week to, you know, what's Will Shorts really like? But I love going face to face. And I take the faces and the people that I meet back with me to the studio because, as you know, we're sitting here, you know, surrounded by walls and clocks and microphones, and there's not a direct connection to the people that we're talking with. And I wanted to have that kind of connection before I was off the air.
And listen, folks, you can meet her personally tonight. The lecture is at 7 p.m. It's at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. That's that beautiful auditorium on the UAA campus. There's lots more information about this on the website, of course. But 7 o'clock tonight, and at 6 o'clock, there's a reception, meet and greet, and reservations are required for that, so call the station. And we've got a caller that I would like to bring on the air. Kristen, give us caller on line 5, please. And Bob, you had a question for Leanne?
Hi, Leanne. Hi, Charles.
Hi, Bob.
I agree with your point. Face-to-face is probably better, but I have to say that your voice has been so much an enduring part of our Sundays for so long. It's a great thing. You do a thoroughly professional job. I'm glad to know you're happy at it. Working with people at NPR has to be one of the, you know, most uplifting experiences in the world. Is that true? And follow-up question, what's the worst thing about your job?
The worst thing, I'll start there, is having to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, just one day a week on Sundays, and not having the weekends that the rest of the world has. And so that's been tough on, you know, a social life. It was great when my kids were little because my days off were Monday and Tuesday, so I was able to do the parent kinds of things like chaperone field trips and that sort. My kids loved it when they were little, when they had to put mommy to bed early on a Saturday. So I would say, I mean, and that's just getting up early. That's the worst part. I've been with the network since 1979, and you know, we started off as kind of a mom and pop storefront, and now we're a kind of a big box store. But at the core of what everyone does at NPR, that core is still there. And I meet some of the most talented, smart, wonderful people that I am still friends with, several of whom are from Alaska, actually. So it's, I would say what I love about NPR, number one, is the work that I do and the people that I work with.
Great. Well, I recommend, as a follow-up, you do something like what Susan Stanberg did and pick out a niche and just be special correspondent for your favorite piece of the news world.
I can do that. And I'm also interested in getting involved in the community where I'm moving. And I've been listening to Jay Allison, who runs a station up in the Cape and Islands, and how he's been recording like 30 seconds of people in the community just telling a story about themselves. And that's something that I think I might want to talk to the public stations down in Delaware about, because there may be a way to do something like that for them. So I'm not going away completely. In fact, you may hear me on NPR or appearing. There may be a different program. I don't know, but I haven't said goodbye to NPR. I've actually offered to be available to them whenever they want me. So that's where it's going to go.
Thank you so much.
Bob, thank you.
Thanks for calling, Bob. And for other listeners out there, the number here is 550-8433, or from outside Anchorage, 888-353-5752. If you have questions for my guest, Leanne Hansen, the outgoing but still for a few more weeks host of Weekend Edition Sunday, and the show is Hometown Alaska, and I'm Charles Wolforth. Bob brought up something, and you mentioned it, that I think is really interesting, which is the evolution of NPR from, like you said, the mom-and-pop storefront to now one of the biggest and most powerful media operations in the country. I think it was Columbia Journalism Review where I read that Morning Edition has more listeners than the Today Show.
Yes.
And so how has that sort of reach and power changed your job?
You have to remember what the mission is all the time, even though we are recognized and we are a big brand now. And I mean, I remember the days when I would go out with a microphone and tell people I was from NPR and they said, "What's that?" And I would say PBS with pictures. I mean, without pictures.
Without pictures,
and
yeah.
they sort of understood, but they didn't know what we are. And today, I get the feeling that people are kind of clawing to get on NPR because it kind of gives them a certain imprimatur of intelligence and that kind of thing. And that's hard because we have to keep remembering why we exist and what our mission is and not get too giddy or bright-eyed about the fact that now we are a recognized media organization. And that's difficult because people come to work to NPR for NPR and they don't quite understand what the mission is. They just know it would look good on their resume to have worked there. And we have to remind people that, you know, do you know what you're getting into?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a service. It's not a product that we produce. It's a service. And if you don't have that kind of zeal, it can be a little disappointing,
mm-hmm.
I think. But I've loved to watch it grow. But I have to say, you know, I used to know everybody on the two floors of the building where we worked, and there are people that come and go at NPR now. They could be there for 6 years, and I've never met them.
Because it's so much bigger. Well,
yeah.
Well, what's interesting, you said you went from mom and pop to big box, but you didn't really.
No, because, it's not big box. It's,
because you've still got that sort of idiosyncratic,
yes.
funny, funky, you know, and you never know what you're going to hear feel to it. And that is it an effort to keep that going when you're being chased by publicists and chased by politicians?
Exactly. And it's also a matter of, I mean, we get a lot of big names that would love to appear on NPR, but my philosophy has been the debut novelist or the debut musician or someone that I can give a boost to,
mm-hmm.
that would not get it elsewhere. And I have turned down big names for interviews. I turned down Justin Bieber and I turned down Madonna because what's left to be said?
Right.
You know, and people will say, oh, well, it wouldn't be the same if you interview them. Maybe not, but nonetheless, wouldn't you like to hear about someone you've never heard of before?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I tend to do people before they become famous, you know, and it's sort of interesting. I'll do one person's product and then the next one, it's the one that gets them the Oscar.
Right. Well, the last 2 weeks, your musical guest, 2 weeks ago, it was a jazz artist, and his name is escaping
Kurt Elling.
Right. Fabulous interview. Went on for 12 and a half minutes.
Yes.
And then the next week, it was Weird Al Yankovic.
Yes.
And I thought, okay, this is the total span of culture.
That's it. It's a little like what you all say about the weather up here.
Right.
If you don't like it, wait a minute. You know, if you don't like what you hear one week, tune in the next. You're going to hear something different. Weird Al. You know, normally I probably wouldn't have done that interview, but he was writing a children's book about, you know, growing up, and he was writing it because he has a child himself. And I thought that was an opportunity to talk to him as Al Yankovic, not Weird Al Yankovic.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Elling, I've loved his music, his singing. He has one of the most amazing voices. But he was with his producer, Don Was, who is a very famous producer,
mm-hmm.
and musician. And just before we started the interview, Don Was said to me, I know you're leaving, and I just want to thank you very much for all the music features you've done. And I'm sitting there saying, Don Was is thanking me for the music. I mean, it never ceases to amaze me who
yeah.
actually listens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No,
yeah.
And that's, if you think about that, you might get a little nervous, right?
Yes. I mean, I did an interview once. Anthony DeCurtis had done a collection of interviews with rock stars. And one of the questions I asked him is, how do you deal with your acute awe of these artists while you're talking to them? And he said, get excited later. So when I finally met Ringo Starr and I'm in person and I'm doing the interview with him, and it was hard not to keep the screaming teenager down while I was doing the interview, but boy, did I do a happy dance in the hallway
uh-huh.
after that interview was over.
Right. Well, I think a lot of people would be interested to know how personal the show is, and that you read a book that you like, you get that person on the air. You hear an album you like, you get that person. It's not like a big... Is that right?
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, if I only put on the things that I like, then I would be the only person that listened to the show.
Right.
I have a terrific team of people that I work with, and they are often passionate about a piece of music that might not be my first choice. But I will listen to it, and if I can connect to it, what I want to be able to do is to be able to execute my producer's passion. And I've done music that I normally wouldn't have done. I just didn't know these people, but they've come to me from my staff. Books are the same way. I get books from publishers all the time, and ones that look interesting, but there are also producers that bring me books. You might be interested in this. Would you like to do this? And we have meetings where everybody pitches things, and some of my pitches are ignored, and and some of them are taken up. So it's really, really, really a team effort. But I tell you, if there's something I really want to do, I'm going to do it. That's my prerogative, I think.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's and I suppose you have to put aside the thought of how bad they want to be on. Right?
Yes,
that's
exactly.
That's not your concern.
No, it's not. And we do get you know, publicists that are relentless about. And it kind of gets annoying when they say, "We think this would be good for your show," and I'm thinking, "How would you know that? You wouldn't know that." But we do have, you know, certain publicists that we've worked through with over the years, and because of that, we often get first notice of something that's coming up. And but again, I love to go to the unknown, and I love when the unknown is able to make something. I'll tell you something. David Letterman and his staff listen to our show. I can give you at least two instances where I've introduced an artist, and within a month, they appear on David Letterman.
That's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool, yeah. Isn't it? And then Will Shortz actually once appeared on David Letterman. And the first thing David Letterman said was, "Now, you do this puzzle segment on Weekend Edition Sunday with Leanne Hansen." Of course, I'm sitting there going, "Oh, my gosh, David Letterman just said my name." And he said that I was too nice during the puzzle, that some people, I should tell them they're too stupid to play the puzzle, "No lapel pin for you," which is a wonderful joke. It's very funny.
Right.
But, you know, no, I would never do that.
I don't think it would be that popular if you did that.
That is the segment of the program that shines a light on a listener. And that was the first interactive part of the show, and it got listeners involved, and then the listeners can tell everybody else what their public radio station is. So it really lifted a lot of boats. And besides, it's fun. You can't prepare for it. I do not know the answers ahead of time.
Well, we had to get into this, so I guess this is a good time to do it.
Sure.
About how that works, because I listen to it and I think, okay, did they cut a few answers out of there?
Right.
Because this guy is really rolling, you know? Or when it's not going that well, you know,
there are only three clues, right? That is one of the reasons, to go back to the beginning, we tape on Friday, but it is done that oxymoronic live on tape. Mm-hmm. And because Will, when he was with us before he got the job as the crossword puzzle editor of the New York Times.
Yeah.
And when he would go into New York on Fridays to do his work at the New York Times, he would go into the bureau and we would tape it on Friday. The second reason is there's a time limit to the puzzle segment. It's usually 7 or 7.5 minutes. And I think it's unfair to put a listener on the spot to not only try and solve Will's diabolical clues, but do it in the amount of time. So there are often more clues than actually get on the air. And we do make the guest look good. I mean, even if they only get three answers. There was one week I was off and I heard the puzzle segment and I came in the next day and I said, was the listener really didn't had a hard time? And they said, yeah, how did you know? I said, because there were only three clues.
Right.
So I know, but we edit to make them, you know, everybody
so
is going to come off good. It's not an embarrassment for them. And then the most important thing is they get to hear themselves on the radio on Sunday and their family and everything. And it just becomes a thrill for them. So I think that's,
And you are chiming in, and are you doing the puzzle along with them as it sounds? And you're not you're not cheating or anything.
No, I don't know what the questions are. So I'll you know, a confession. There are sometimes when Will gives the clue, and I don't understand it, and he gives the first one, and the listener's getting it, and sometimes by the third one, I finally figure out what Will's looking for. But luckily, I've had a great listener player to kind of.
Are you one of those super sharp puzzle minds, or are you?
No, I think it's because I've, first of all, I have a mind full of useless information. I mean, it's part of being a generalist, I think. I know a little bit of everything.
When you're a journalist for a long time, you end up that way. You can really be a bore.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you know, trivial games and things like that. I love them. I do the crossword puzzle. I do the Times crossword puzzle. In fact, on Sundays, I play this game with myself at 8 o'clock Eastern time when the show goes out. I open my New York Times magazine and I have the Sunday Times puzzle and I actually work on it during the show, as well as tweeting, as well as doing the interviews, as well as reading the scripts. But it centers me when I'm doing the crossword puzzle, and my goal is to complete it by 10 o'clock. And if I haven't completed it by 10 o'clock, then I put it aside.
Well, you must be a pretty good multitasker then.
I'm all right. It's strange. People say, how can that make you relaxed? I said, I don't know. It just does. Maybe it's the idea of using my hands while I'm on the radio. But I do like puzzles, but I'm not a rabid puzzle person the way that Will is. It's not in my blood.
Well, it's funny how that segment has become such a calling card or such a signature, and it's, you know, very famous. I mean, it's a thing that's in people's minds
for sure,
everywhere.
For sure. And it was, I mean, of course, Will, but I truly believe it was the fact that we involved people who listen. Mm-hmm. And so they become part of our program. And that was an incentive. And in the early days when we only had about fewer than 200,000 listeners when I took on board, came on board, most people would just listen to the puzzle segment. And then gradually over the years began listening to the rest of the show. And so now people on average listen for about an hour and 15 minutes out of a two-hour show, which is pretty much unheard of in broadcasting. But it's the puzzle that brings people in. Kids play it with their families, and I discovered when we talked to one of the commanders in Afghanistan that a lot of members of the military listen to NPR in their various outposts and do play the puzzle. So we have, with his permission, we asked, and we're putting together some of the puzzle prizes that we give out to our listeners, the books and so forth, to send to the troops overseas so they can have something to play with. Yeah.
And you've actually published a puzzle book. A
couple of puzzle books that have the puzzles from the early years that you can go back and recapture.
Now, you're one of the very few NPR anchors, reporters who's not actually written your own book,
yet.
Right?
No, I mean,
your future?
I don't know. I mean, I question whether or not after writing in short form, you know, 30-second intro, whether I can sustain a long-form book. I might try fiction. I mean, that's what appeals to me. The idea of writing a memoir, maybe. I mean, I'm sure other people might be interested in it. But, you know, maybe I'll turn it into fiction so the names can be changed to protect the innocent.
Yeah. So you mentioned that you started out with 200,000 listeners. How many today?
3.5 million.
Wow.
On a Sunday.
Yeah.
On a Sunday morning. We have, it's remarkable that we have that kind of listenership. I do think we have more listeners than Meet the Press on Sunday. A lot of it has to do with the fact that when we came on the air, we were a full-grown, produced, good public radio program. And Sundays was the place where everybody, the radio stations, would dump their public affairs program to satisfy FCC requirements. And all of a sudden, this professional two-hour news magazine was on the radio, and it had not existed. So I think that's how we were able to grow.
We have a caller on now. Pam, did you have a question for Leanne Hansen?
Yes, and I'm a graduate of UMass, so go with
Oh, hi, it. Pam. How are you? Wicked smart, huh?
Yeah. And I hope this isn't an impertinent question, but one of the things I thought was really fascinating was during the first, I believe, the first Iraq war.
Yes.
And I believe your husband was in that.
He was a guest of the Iraqi army for about a week.
Yes.
And your husband is Neil Conan.
Neil Conan, yes.
How you balance that and just... I thought it was really interesting what you had done at that. It still sticks with me.
Yes, it was. It was very interesting because I found out that he had been captured early on a Monday morning. I mean, by early, I mean 2:30 in the morning. And I had done the show on Sunday. So those first 2 days were my days off. And a lot of time was spent making a lot of phone calls to try to get as much information. And I did go to the producers of the show and said, I don't think it would be a good idea for me to host the show this week because I'm personally involved with what's going on. And so what they did was they gave me the week off. So God forbid I would have to cover news of my husband's death on the air. And they were very considerate about that. So I was then able, my children were only 8 and 10 at that time. And this was a something major in their lives, something that I think still affects them. And that was, my focus had to be on the family and not on the program, although everybody at NPR was just amazing in trying to help me find out what had gone on. I have learned from that what it's like to be part of a story rather than covering a story. And I understand now how a lot of families of anyone who's involved in a tragedy feels while that's going on, having lived it. And so it's informed the way that I will often talk to people who are victims of tragedy. I often will say I don't want to call members of the family because I know that they're being inundated with phone calls from all the media outlets. And I would rather talk to someone who knows the family and can probably tell, like a clergyman or a neighbor, because I don't want to impose on the family that has to deal with whatever tragedy is happening. And I will never ask anyone the question, how do you feel? It's just not a question that you know what the answer is ahead of time. It also informed me that you can't always believe what you hear and what you see. There were reports that my husband was with a group of journalists that had been killed in a firefight in Basra. And I heard about that on a commercial radio station. And so I made a lot of phone calls and was able to reach the conclusion that that was not true, even though it was being broadcast on other outlets at the same time. And so I know what it's like to be a family member when erroneous information about your loved one is being put on the air. And at the end, when I heard that he had been released, there was going to be a press conference that I should watch. And I watched it, and I didn't see him. And I received phone calls from people that I work with and others. Did you see him? He was there. Are you sure? And I did not see him. And about 10 minutes after that press conference, I mean, I was pretty despairing. I got a phone call from the International Committee of the Red Cross to confirm that my husband had indeed been released. And later when I spoke to him, he said he had not participated in that press conference because he didn't want to be part of a dog and pony show where Iraqi guards would have their guns out while the cameras were off and put them behind their backs when the cameras were on. And Neil had told them, if you want me at this press conference, give me back my tape recorder and I will cover it. He knew that it would mean that I would not see him on the air, but what it taught me is sometimes even some things that you think you see do not exist. And it made me value accuracy in reporting stories of this nature more than anything else in the world because of the effect that it has on the people who love whoever is in this situation.
Yeah.
Learned a lot.
Great question, Pam. Do you have
any, wonderful.
You want to add to your question?
Only that I think that was, as a listener, I thought it was important because then I could understand or knew to trust Leanna on some of these stories, particularly the ones that were incomplete or had many different viewpoints and couldn't be verified.
And
of how she was handling this, I appreciated that very much as a listener.
Pam, thank you. I actually can give you an example. During the second Iraq War, Shoshana Johnson, who was with the mechanical unit with Jessica Lynch, and they had been captured, and that was on a Sunday, and she was also released on a Sunday. And the day that she was released, we were getting scattered, you know, reports that she had been released, and there was a shaky videotape of someone who may have looked like her. And there was a question of whether or not we should go on the air with that she had been released, and I reminded them that sometimes the things you see aren't really what you're seeing. So we waited, and maybe we weren't first with the news that she had been released, but we were right.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, Pam.
Thank you, Pam.
I want to
have fun on the beach.
Thank you. I will.
Well, it seems to me that, as you know, we've been listening to the events in the Middle East, and hearing some of these NPR reporters who are in very dangerous situations. Mm-hmm. And for the friends and for the family members, that's obviously got to be very, very difficult. How did you deal with it with your husband after this? I mean, I as a reporter, I know that my wife doesn't know everything that I've done,
right.
But right, you know, now you know how much danger he's in.
Right. And, you know, I can tell you that just 3 weeks after he came back, he went back to Iraq and went up into the Kurdish section of the country. And for him, it was a little like getting on the bike after you fall off to go back and realize you
but
can
it's,
still
it's
do
tougher.
It. And for me,
it's tougher for the one at home.
As well, yes, it is. But that's who he is. I knew that when I married him, and I knew he was a reporter, and that's what I signed on for.
So you never thought of just saying, no, you're staying here?
I would never do that.
Okay, well, this has been really interesting, and we're going to have another half hour with Leanne Hansen and with your calls. And we're going to have a break in just a moment, but I want to give everybody the details on Leanne's talk this evening. It's at 7 o'clock at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium on the UAA campus. $35 admission, and the proceeds go to benefit APR and the Alaska News Fund, so an excellent cause. And so we're going to be back, and when we come out of the break, I'll give you the phone numbers once again, and we'll be talking some more with Leanne Hansen. So thanks for being with us.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. A copy of Hometown Alaska will be available this afternoon on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. Love that jazzy new music we've got. It's Hometown Alaska. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guest today is Leanne Hansen. Just to correct the inestimable BD Trentino on what you just heard, the show will not be repeated at 7 tonight. Why? Because you're expected to be listening to Leanne in person at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. And you can buy tickets at the door. And I think it's going to be a really interesting and fun evening and get to meet somebody you've been hearing all these years. Do call in. Your opportunity to ask Leanne a question right now is open at 550-8433, outside Anchorage, toll-free 888-353-5752, and we take emails at hometownalaska@kska.org. And now I'd like to go to a caller. Carol, did you have a question or a comment for Leanne?
Actually, thank you, for first of all, for taking my call, and secondly, Leanne Hansen, this is an honor to speak with you.
Oh, thank you, Carol.
Much. Thank you so much for your service. I'm one of your 3 million listeners.
Lovely.
And they're going to have a heck of a time replacing you, because one of the things that has always come across, it's always struck me as being very noble about your presentations, is the compassion, the genuine caring that you present in your stories, as well as the puzzle people. Mm-hmm. When someone gets stumped, you're right there with them. You make it very human, and that is so appreciated. That quality alone is going to be almost impossible to replace. So.
Right, but you have to remember, I had to walk in Susan Stamberg's shoes. All right, so and people gradually began to accept me on Sunday morning. I really don't have a say in who will replace me, but I know that they are looking, they understand. I mean, you know, my reign will end, and I'm sure that whoever takes my place, you know, you're going to grow to know and respect them as well. I thank you very much. I consider it a very high compliment that you're telling me that I have compassion. I love talking to people, and that's always how I viewed what I do. I mean, even if from a famous musician, you know, to someone who predicts how long the winters go by looking at woolly worms, you know, I mean, I think, and politicians and, you know, muckety mucks, I treat them all, we're all human beings. And, you know, the philosophy of NPR is to have civil discourse, discussions, even if there are disagreements on the side. I think we learn more when we hear people actually talking to one another about the problems and, you know, finding a middle ground where solutions can be found. And I continue to bring that to the program. But I, no matter who it is, it's another person. And I'm curious about who they are. And I'm not interested in doing the, you know, the kind of soundbite radio. I mean, even when I'm talking sometimes to some of my correspondents around the country or around the world, I appreciate them for what they're doing. I know what it's like for them to be in that situation. And so I try to make their job as easy for them so that they are able to tell their story to you. So it's we're people here. We're not headlines That's been my philosophy, and I thank you for actually being able to perceive that.
All right.
Well, and thank you for a beautiful job done.
Carol, thank you very much for listening and supporting me.
Thanks, Carol. Good comment. I appreciated having you call. And now we'd like to go to Shannon, who is in Eagle River. That's actually part of Anchorage, but they don't like to admit that. Shannon, did you have a comment for Leanne Hansen?
Hey, Shannon.
Nope. Shannon is not, maybe she'll call back. An email came in. Leanne, could you comment on the quality and quantity of cable news? And that's a big issue because it affects so much of what's going on in journalism.
Sure. Right? That is something that we've seen come along in the 20 years. And it's quantity and it's quality. I think there's a philosophy now that is you need to get the radical opposite sides of every issue into a studio to talk about that so that fireworks are produced, so that eyeballs like to watch. It's like an accident, or it's like a drive-by interview, and it sells advertising, and that's why it's done. There are so many news outlets now that you have a hard time figuring out what is accurate. I mean, I do, when news is breaking, I am watching CNN. I am to see what they can tell me, but oftentimes they don't have any information, and yet they're going on with speculation. And that's what it's become. It's become speculation and opinion rather than information. The speculation, I do remember in the early days of this Gulf War, a repeating loop of footage of what looked like a car burning. And the anchor actually at one point said, "We don't know what this is, but we know you want to see it."
Right.
And my response is, "I want to know what it is. Are you going to show me or what it is?" So, you know, there's a tendency to get sensational. Mm-hmm. And it also
makes
our job
harder. Does that put pressure on you at all?
Yeah.
Because the stuff is rolling out and you don't want to miss the story, right?
When JFK Jr. died, I started receiving emails about why we weren't reporting on the flight instructor that was in the plane with him. Well, the reason we weren't reporting on that is because there was no flight instructor. And that had been a story that had been perpetuated in the media during the coverage of that particular accident. And we could never confirm it, and so we didn't do it. But it's interesting because some of our listeners were getting information from other outlets and were wondering why we weren't reporting it. And often it's because it wasn't true.
Right. Well, do you feel that you are don't have to be as aggressive as maybe a big metro newspaper or certainly these cable people because of you, your listeners have got a different expectation from NPR, or do you still want to be out there and get the story
first
like everyone
else? Do you have to get the story? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always good. We do breaking stories, but sometimes we now have a new investigative unit in NPR, and so NPR is breaking news. Howard Burke is doing reports on the mines, for example, anything Danny Zwerdling has ever done. Now talking about the care of the veterans with PTSD, so that we're starting to generate our own investigative reporting, which I think is a great thing.
And that's part of you moving into a new role in the media environment, isn't it? Because as the newspapers are kind of going away.
Yes, yeah. So that we have that kind of reporting. And then also what distinguishes us is the fact that we do have boots on the ground all around the world. And so, for example, when things began to get in Cairo, when the popular protests started, Peter Kenyon, whom I know is from Alaska.
You used to live a block from me.
Yes. he was already in position and having lived in Cairo for a while, knew the context rather than just flying in to cover the event. It's very important to put big events in some kind of context. And it's also one of the things about, for example, covering what's going on in Libya now is there is a lack of information. And I think it's incumbent upon us, and this is something that NPR does, is to be transparent. You know, even if we're talking to an eyewitness in the middle of a protest with gunfire going on behind them, as Michelle Norris did, you still have to be careful because you're getting an eyewitness report, but it's not you're not sure if it's in the context. So you have to keep reminding people that information is hard to come by, who we're talking to and why we're talking to them, and not pretend that this one person has the complete knowledge of the whole story. So,
well, it all points to the changing role and increasing role of NPR. And it seems to me that another story that kind of pointed to that was the whole Juan Williams thing, and the fact that suddenly who works for NPR as a commentator is a big national news story, which right. in the past certainly would have been the case. I mean, what was your view on that whole thing?
That is a tough one. I've known Juan a long time. And in fact, after he was replaced as host of Talk of the Nation, he became a commentator for our show and for Scott's show. And he was on a contract, and I taught him how to use a microphone. But we knew he appeared on Fox. Some of our other correspondents appear on other news shows. And I thought it was a convergence, an unfortunate convergence of events. I think there was some internal management angst that did not have to do with Juan Williams. It's something that had internally, in terms of management, it was a mistake was made. I mean, nobody should hear that they're being let go. A phone call in late at night.
Right.
That's just not human. So we had that, but it also happened right during the midterm elections, and there are elements that are always looking for ways to demonize NPR, and because if we aren't demonized, then they have nothing to talk about. So it was this confluence of events that sort of blew up. And it just kept getting bigger than it really actually was. And people were using they were being opportunistic. And there's been a board inquiry that I'm not privy to. And of course, the vice president for news has also resigned over this issue. And I think it was totally blown out of proportion by both sides, frankly, by both sides.
I thought it was interesting in that it points out that you really are in the big time now where you're going to be playing with the rough game.
Right.
And you
it's
better
a
be
rough
ready
game.
For it in
I
some
know.
Sense.
I know. And there were, I mean, you know, they it's like they're, sometimes you just feel you've been they're waiting for an opportunity. And
right.
I don't even want to say that because it devolves into us versus them. But understand, I mean, I think a lot of it has to go back to the beginnings of NPR, which was born out of the culture wars of the Vietnam War. And there has been a continuing perception that NPR is the voice of the left. And because in the early days we were broadcasting voices against the war that were not being broadcast on commercial media. And I think people still see us as part of that dichotomy. But listen, I mean, really, I was on a subway once wearing my NPR jacket, and a gentleman asked me if I worked for NPR, and I said yes, but I didn't tell him who I was. And he began to rail that we were starting to pander to the right, and we weren't covering, you know, the issues, and we weren't advocating, you know, the issues. And I have to keep reminding people that we are not an advocacy organization. We are a journalistic organization. If you want to change the world, become a politician or a social worker, if you want to report on stories, even if you may not agree with the basis or the premise or whatever, the objectivity of covering a story, then that's why you want to work for NPR. And it makes us more valuable because we are objective.
Even if you're covering a Republican congressman who wants to zero out the
absolutely.
The budget, you
absolutely.
Just have to keep it straight.
You have to. You have to. You have to keep it straight. And I think it's a shame that this has come up again, because I think there's a major misunderstanding about how NPR works, how public broadcasting works, and the role that the member stations, including this one, play, because they don't understand. Unlike Fox, we do not dictate what the affiliates play. We provide the programming, and then the station will program it according to the needs of its individual community. So it's not a homogeneous network. And I think that's a big misunderstanding about what NPR. But we're an easy target.
Yeah. Okay. We have another caller, Becky. Did you have a question for Leanne?
We're losing them by the boatload. Becky, you there?
Becky called in, and we and I think she even called back, and I don't know what's happening. Becky, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can.
Oh, go right ahead.
I just wanted to say that I reached my 70th birthday last fall, and I'm finding that all of the people I'm used to are disappearing on me.
Oh, I'm not disappearing, Becky. I know. I mean, you know, figure you've been my companion for the last 20 years as well. Yeah. I thank you very much for saying that, but I'm not being disappeared. I mean, it's not I'm there one day and gone the next. I'm trying to get people used to the idea that this is I'll tell you, I feel like I'm dating you, but honey, we're breaking up. It's not you, it's me. Okay? But I thank you for that. There was an elderly gentleman, I was visiting the station in Seattle, KPLU, and a gentleman came up to me and was crying copious tears. And I just hugged him and I said, you know, I wanted to make it better, but I do understand that this is a personal decision of mine.
Yeah, I know that. It's just that as I get older, there's less that I am familiar with anymore.
Mm.
You know, but what with all the new gadgets and everything, I don't own a cell phone. I don't want one.
Mm-hmm. And so radio has been a real companion for you these years. Yeah, yeah.
And I would just add that a voice of a fellow adult on the air, you know, that a mature voice is nice. I mean, a lot of media that's really not there.
No, not right. At all. It's you know, again, there's this whole idea that we need the youth demographic. But on the other hand, you know, I'm one who likes to listen to voices of wisdom, you know, that have aged a bit to learn right. from mistakes and that kind of thing. And I'll tell you, some of the best interviews I've done have been people over the age of 70, because I think that they just have so much to teach us. I remember interviewing the Delaney sisters when they were 101 and 103. And they were pioneers, African-American women. And I just felt so blessed to be able to hear their stories and then to be able to tell their stories to the rest of the world. So keep listening, Becky. You might know. You might, I mean, you know, you might find a new companion for yourself.
Okay.
Thanks
Thank
for
you
calling.
For calling, Becky.
It makes me think of Daniel Shore, who is so wonderful. And I just really look forward to hearing him talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
And was he a good friend of yours?
Yes, I miss him more than you will ever know. I mean, not only was he a good friend, but he was a mentor. He taught me so much. And, you know, the day that he told me, he said, "You're a real journalist," I was just glowing because I felt, you know, if I could earn Daniel Shore's respect, then I was doing all right. I miss him every day.
Yeah, I miss listening to him, and I have imprinted in my memory when he's saying, "Brother, can you spare
a dime?" That's right.
That should be like a link at the top of your webpage because that was a really precious moment.
It was a precious moment, and he also, I mean, you know, you weren't privy to it, but we used to hear him sing La Vie en Rose in the hallways. he loved to sing, and he was just funny and smart. And had this memory that he could go back to events in history 40 years ago and draw a line to what's happening today. Mm-hmm. And we're losing, you know, those minds.
Yeah, what a life he led.
He sure did.
Yeah. So we've got Shannon back, who we lost earlier. Shannon, do you have a question?
I actually don't have a question. I just have a comment. I want to express my appreciation to Leanne and everyone at NPR for the humanity that you bring to the stories. I feel like I'm listening to friends, not just reporters. And it's been said many other ways, but you treat everyone with such dignity and every subject with such concern and truth. And I really appreciate that.
Shannon, thank you very much. I take that as a very high compliment. It's wonderful to know that is what we try to do. And when I hear from you that you tell us we're doing it, I mean, that makes the 3 o'clock in the morning on Sunday worthwhile.
Absolutely.
Thank
I
you,
will
Shannon.
I'll continue listening, but I will miss you.
Thank you, Shannon, very much. I'm going to miss you, too.
Yes, and thanks for sticking it out and calling back. I appreciate that very much. And here's another one, an email that's come in. says, just please tell Leanne that her voice will be missed as part of my Sunday mornings and wish her well.
Thank you.
This tour you're taking has got to just have you glowing. Has it all been like this?
It has all been like this. And I am moved to tears every time. I meet people who have been listening for years. I meet people who have been listening for an hour. And I find it interesting that when I meet folks, when I come here, they come up and say hello, and hello, they want to meet me. And then for some reason, I think it's just because of something I put out, but I get to hear their stories. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, hi, I'd like to meet you now. Now listen to my story. And I love that when I hear, you know, who people are, what they've done, what they like, what they don't. You know, it's I take everything back with me to Washington, and it informs me when I'm on the air. I just keep remembering the people that I met.
Yeah. Well, it's a perfect lead-in for me to let people know again that there's an opportunity for you to meet Leanne Hansen tonight at 7 o'clock at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. Tickets are for sale at the door, and she'll be speaking. And there's also a reception that takes place an hour earlier. You'd need to make reservations for that. I actually don't know if those are still available. Yeah, they are available. So you can still get tickets to the 6 o'clock reception to meet Leanne. Call the station if you want to do that. Show is Hometown Alaska. Usually we're on Wednesdays, but we had Leanne Hansen from NPR's Weekend Sunday Morning Edition here, and so we had to get her into the studio to talk. Something that strikes me is that you've got a warm and wonderful voice and that human touch, and that's very true, but the reason that all works also is because of the show you've put together. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it is comfortable to listen to and stimulating to listen to on Sunday morning when you're reading your Sunday paper, drinking your coffee. And I was wondering how you put that magazine together. Obviously, it doesn't all happen at the last minute.
No.
What's the process of putting it together?
Well, we have a regular work week, Wednesday through Saturday. The staff works from about 9 until 6, unless we're out, you know, during reporting. And then Sunday is our early morning.
So that staff is just working on your show.
Well, actually, in the recent budget constraints, we've merged staffs with Scott Simon's show on Saturday. So it's like one staff is producing both shows, which has become a little bit problematic, particularly when folks come in on Saturday morning to get, you know, help launch Scott's show, and they have to leave by 2 o'clock. But then some of them are just getting the chance to work on the stuff for Sunday. So it's a little crazy. We have a weekly process where we'll have a meeting on Wednesday where we look at what's happening, where the coverage is, what the news might be. We have long-term interviews where I did an interview last week that's not going to air until April because it happened to be with the availability of the artist was now, but the CD won't be released until later. So I'm often doing interviews for shows in the future. I will do interviews during the week for that particular Sunday. We look at for example, the National Governors Association having its winter meeting in Washington. We knew it was happening on the weekend, and so we knew we wanted to be able to talk to a governor. As it turned out, we got Chris Gregoire, the governor of Washington State, who's the chair, and we had talked to her before. She was a friend of the program. A lot of interviews will happen on Sunday morning, particularly those that are overseas. Some are live, and some have been in the works for weeks. So it's a constant planning for the present and the future. Mm-hmm. And it's all during an 80-hour work. We have futures meetings when we talk about, we have things lined up now for the next 2 months.
Wow.
Not a lot. I mean, mostly the feature things are what we set.
But then on Sunday mornings, all hell may break loose.
It can break loose.
And what are the sort of, give us some examples of some of the more exciting things that or terrifying things that have happened, because you've got to think on your feet and pull it all together. Right?
I remember when the former President Bush was going to announce the beginning of the war, the offensive in Afghanistan, and we heard the news the president was going to give a press conference at noon, and so we did our first feed from 8 until 10, and then from 10 until 12, and there are not a lot of resources available on a Sunday morning at the network. So I was in a small studio without a computer and without a television, where I basically had to talk until the president came up to the mic. And that was a real test of doing it. I've gone to bed, and then I remember being awakened by Neil, and I said, "Why are you waking me up so early?" It was like 2 o'clock. And he said, "Princess Diana's dead." And I went, "Oh," I said, "do you have any coffee?" And we went in, and we didn't devote the entire show, but a lot of things went away. Gabrielle Giffords, the report of her injuries came about 1:30 on a Saturday. So there were things that we had planned for Sunday that we had to just put aside, some of which we couldn't air because they were pegged to that particular day to accommodate that particular story. Last week, on the early feed in the East Coast, we had an interview with David Folkenflik about the media coverage of the popular uprisings. And it turned out we could get in touch with Martin Fletcher, who was in Tripoli. So I had to go and do the interview with Martin. And then, within like 5 or 10 minutes, without a script, nothing, just seat in my pants interview, to go on to the second feed, because that was to find somebody in Tripoli was very important. And so we had to King. I think the longest day I ever had was the day Saddam Hussein was captured. I mean, that was I went on the air at 8 and I did not get off the air until 3. And it was straight shot, guest after guest, new. Everything was new. And that was
Are you the kind of person who thrives on that, or do you kind of wish that that wasn't happening?
I kind of wish that that wasn't happening. Uh-huh. And, I sort of had to remind people that I was in the studio, and could someone please get me a Coca-Cola, otherwise I was going to die.
Uh-huh, right. Well, we just have another minute or so left, but I wanted to ask, you've had such a great career, and it sounds like you've had just wonderful fun, and do you ever talk to young people about getting into this line of work and what the sacrifices are and what the rewards are?
I do. I mean, it is a sacrifice. You have to be available to do the job. You have to be, I mean, if you're a reporter, you have to be willing to go anywhere at any time. And people often ask me, how do I get in to public broadcasting? And the first thing I tell them is go volunteer at your local station answer the phones, because you'll see how the station works. You'll meet the people who work there. And if you have skills, people will notice. I've had people go from administrative assistant positions at the network to producing a program at a local station simply by going to volunteer. So, it's you have to tell them, you have to be willing to work. I mean, I'm a radio gal that's willing to work weekends, and that's why I got to stay at the job. But I love the job.
No, that's the only reason.
I love the job, right? Because it's inside work and no heavy lifting.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Oh,
you
know, Charles, I've so enjoyed it.
Good. Yeah, I just I will miss you as well, because I sit there, I read my paper and sip my coffee and
but
look forward to the puzzle show.
But I also know you have a book in your bag, and the minute we get off the air, you're going to say, I think this would make a good interview.
That's right. Well, my publicist is going to kill me because I didn't bring the book, but I'm going to get your email address.
Thank you, Charles.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. It's been Hometown Alaska. We've been talking with Leanne Hansen, and there's still definitely a chance to hear more of Leanne and to meet her in person this evening at the Wendy Williamson Auditorium. It starts at 7 o'clock, tickets at the door, and that reception is just an hour earlier, and call the station if you're interested in that. So that's it for Hometown Alaska for today. My name is Charles Wolforth. Thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music for Hometown Alaska is Lead Dog, composed and performed by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Views expressed on Hometown Alaska are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org, and CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.